You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, as we move through 2021 with My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, a reminder that we're getting into our 15th anniversary year. And thank you all who are listening now, whether you've been listening a long time, as some have, or a short time. A reminder about the Patreon, patreon.com/MHCBUYP. Get more episodes, get some back episodes that aren't available to the public yet, get advanced episodes. A couple things there that I'm particularly proud of. One is Draft Johnson, special podcast, nearly 2 hours, where we discuss the possibility that Lyndon Johnson was seeking the nomination in 1968, despite his speech saying otherwise. Eventually, that's going to be put on the public site, probably later in the year. But if you want it now, go get it. Sign up for the Patreon. It could be as little as $3 a month. Another thing that I've done is just opened up one of my scrapbooks. I've been doing a lot of research, particularly on the 1890s. And you know why? Well, I feel like it's a modernizing decade in American politics and pulling a lot of threads. And what I'm doing in that episode is reading the scrapbook of what many called the mauve decade because of the popularity of that color in fashion in that year. 130 content items that right now are not available on the public site. Today, right in time for President's Day, we have Jeremy Anderberg. He is the podcast producer at Art of Manliness. That's artofmanliness.com. It's a men's lifestyle website and also a podcast. He is also the creator and the man behind the readmorebooks.co newsletter, where he has book reviews, author interviews, lots of good stuff, book recommendations. If you like to read, readmorebooks.co, sign up for that, give him your email. He'll shoot out that newsletter every Friday. Well, I'm here with Jeremy Anderberg, and he is, among other things, a listener to My History Can Beat Up Your Politics and a producer for the Art of Manliness podcast. And Jeremy, thanks for coming on.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We are talking today about a bunch of things, but one of the things that Jeremy explained to me is that you've read a book. Now, can you say it's on every president?
Correct. Yeah, I've actually just recently completed the task, so I can now say that I have indeed read at least one biography of every president. I finished up just before Inauguration Day this year, so it's good timing.
That's great. I mean, presidents are a good way to kind of anchor history. And believe it or not, there are a few listeners who have contacted me over the years in similar projects, and they're at different stages. I don't know where they all are. One of them does illustrations and has a great Instagram, Project POTUS Pages, and she's got a great page with illustration of each time she finishes reading a book, she illustrates things about it. Do you have favorite presidents?
You know, I sort of go in and out. I mean, it's hard not to come away from Lincoln without just really loving the guy and thinking him for sure among the top few, as he's always ranked. You know, before I started in, I would have listed Teddy Roosevelt as a favorite. But after reading about him, you know, it's interesting. He actually has so much energy and vitality. It's almost hard to relate to as a, you know, a dad with three kids, like, man, reading about him just makes me feel kind of tired. So, you know, that was kind of funny. I still, you know, really enjoy him. But the presidents I enjoyed reading about the most were sort of the curmudgeonly, but also relatable guys. You know, John Adams writes in his journal about being distracted by his kids and about sleeping in too late when he wanted to be doing other things. And you have guys like, you know, William Howard Taft, who I love talking about. He's usually overshadowed by TR. And his presidency was not that great. But he was just an incredibly lovable, likable guy, which is part of why he wasn't a great politician. But I certainly came to really enjoy him as a person.
Yeah, I mean, I've with the amount of reading I've done for the cast and things, you get so many different perspectives and changing perspectives on people. And we elevate Theodore Roosevelt in our understanding of history, and we should, of course. But he's no kind of guy that any average person can relate to, because he's like a superhero. I mean, he's not an average guy, even in his time. And I was reading recently a biography from George B. McClellan Jr., so the son of the Union general, also became a congressman, later mayor of New York. And has some great stories. And there you get the perspective of Theodore Roosevelt being kind of like an annoyance in his, in a speech where they were honoring his father in New York City. And Roosevelt is just almost hyperventilating talking to George B. McClellan, who was mayor at this point, about some slight that was done to him in the 1904 election, which he won overwhelmingly anyway. So
TR, like you said, he really wanted all the attention on him. He always wanted to be the belle of the ball. Sort of, you know, almost like a Churchill in that regard. They're very similar. These sort of otherworldly characters who are just terribly fun to read about, but incredibly hard to relate to, for sure.
I think John Hay at one point tells the ambassador to France that, you know, you have to remember the president's like a 9-year-old boy. I know that one of the things you had mentioned was that some presidents are easier to read about than others.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when it comes to just the biographies themselves, it's really interesting. You get the same guys written about over and over and over again. Of course, you have Washington has thousands of biographies about him. Said that Lincoln has, you know, 16,000 plus books about him. The same is true for FDR, Theodore Roosevelt, etc. Then you get these sort of black holes, particularly in the 19th century, between, you know, Andrew Jackson and Lincoln. There's not much in terms of presidential biography. And then there's another stretch after Grant and sort of before McKinley. These are decades-long stretches where it's simply very difficult to find readable modern biographies. And I've sort of wondered why this is. You know, of course, there's a little bit less interest in those guys who aren't as well-known. But I think part of that that there's this just cycle of biographers writing about the same guys. And so modern readers will just read about the same people. And you have these presidents who just kind of get lost to history, very interestingly, even though, you know, no matter what happens to get to the office of president, there's going to be this inevitable, incredible mix of ambition and failure and success and drama and corruption.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the bearded presidents always get short shrift, you know, probably. And I think they're getting more attention because of podcasting. But before that, just short shrift, all of them struggled. All of them had a huge political history. Garfield, you know, is known as just the guy that got shot, if he's known at all. Guy with a beard got shot. But has an incredible career, does an incredible thing to get that nomination. I mean, we've gotten into that story before on this cast. You know, nobody had an easy ride. It was not, you know, maybe Franklin Pierce did. It was a hotly contested position, both the nomination and general election, all the time. See, Pierce probably did. He was probably put there a little bit more. Buchanan really did struggle for it and want to be president before he became it, so he was pretty ambitious. Yeah, it's never became an office that was not contested hotly by at least two types of parties or factions within a party.
Yeah, even though, you know, the office has vacillated between weak and strong, you know, part of it with those presidents who aren't aren't written about as much is that they were just seen as weak presidents who were kind of bowing to the whims of Congress. But still, you know, you have someone like John Tyler, who thankfully had a wonderful new biography published about him just last year, but from a university press, interestingly, it was not picked up by a major publisher, but it's very well written. And he's a guy who, you know, ultimately pledged his loyalty to the Confederacy, had 15 children, the most of any president, including one grandson still alive today, I mean, which is just mind-boggling when you think about it, right? I mean, there's so much drama in his story that he's a guy, you know, thankfully he has been written about, but just kind of shows that no matter who it is, there's a great story to be written.
The story of the Grand Canyon, it was just two, and unfortunately the other guy passed away, but he was still playing tennis up until the end there, and we were, we talked about recently how Tyler tried, you know, there is that story that he became a part of the Confederacy in his last year, and that he's actually buried under a Confederate flag, technically foreign soil, some might say. I've seen books that say it that way. Lincoln would never have acknowledged that it was ever foreign soil, but also he did attempt to conduct a peace convention and tried to bring all the sides together. Now, it was all bringing the sides together in a way that James Buchanan would like, so it was never going to fly. But it was, you know, before he was a Confederate, there was an attempt by Virginia, led by him, to try to put things together. And that should always be an important part of his history. One thing I noted that I did not have time to put in a previous podcast about the Lincoln train that I did was that he also has this comment during that convention that really there's a mistake in the Constitution. We should be changing it every 50 years. Every couple of generations, we should revisit the Constitution. And something that so this guy that actually became a Confederate and also felt what many people feel today, which is that the Constitution should be changed every once in a while. And, this has been great. I definitely want to talk to you more about presidents and biographies that you like and everything like that. But let's get into, we'll talk about our top obscure facts about presidents. What do we think here? Do you have 10, 8, 5? What do you think is best?
Perfect. Yeah, I probably have, let's say 8 or 9. Yeah.
Let's do 8.
Yeah, sure.
So we'll count down from 8, and that'll give you a total of 16. Here we go. And coming in at number 8, Jeremy, what's your obscure fact?
Perfect. So this will again be Taft. You know, again, I love Taft. Part of the reason he got into the presidency, decided to go that path versus pursuing a judgeship, which was really his dream. It's part of it because his wife, Nellie, was incredibly ambitious and really wanted that office of the presidency. So he kind of went along with it. And his wife was very much an equal and important advisor for him. There were very few presidents who really considered their wives to be their equals in the office and in politics, and Taft was one of those. So he kind of did it for her, at least partially. But sadly, she had a devastating stroke very early in his term, just a couple months, I believe, and was rendered unable to fulfill that role of advisor. Couldn't talk, had trouble walking, etc. And so Taft, you know, sort of going into the presidency, relying on his wife being there, that she had this stroke. And so he hated being president, had a really terrible 4-year experience. Of all the presidents, probably enjoyed it the least and was very glad to be able to be done with it. Ultimately did get his judgeship later in life. But I always thought it was interesting that Taft was kind of pushed into it and then just really hated being there. You kind of feel for the poor guy.
Yeah, and I did not know that about his wife. You know, I it's always good to learn new things. So my number 8, no president, including Joe Biden, no president has been an only child. Just a quirk of history. Does it say something about the presidency? Maybe it does. Maybe it does not. That includes Obama. He does have half siblings. It also includes Franklin Roosevelt, who had a older, much older half-brother, James Rosie Roosevelt, who died in the 1920s.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, now some of its statistics, one-child families have grown over in recent time. And so given the years, especially since we have a president that's so old and the last president was older, we're not getting the youngins into the presidency just yet. You're not experiencing some demographic changes that occurred. So let's see here. Number of mothers who reach the end of their childbearing years with one child doubled from 11% in 1976 to 22 in 2015. So there's more only children. That means it's more likely that this trend will be broken.
Yeah, interesting. I'm actually an only child. I wonder if, you know, if it has to do something with competition. I didn't have siblings to compete with. That's obviously, it's certainly a part of elections and campaigning. So yeah, that's interesting.
I think it's a mix, and it's definitely that nature, nurture, environment, what you do, all of those things. Like, you know, Teddy Roosevelt would shame us because he'd always say, like, it's about what you do and that. But it does seem to show something. Now, if you're including like half siblings, it's hard to say. Like, Roosevelt had pretty limited contact with James Rosie. So it's kind of like Franklin Roosevelt almost was one. And, you know, so quick run for president, Jeremy, is the answer.
Yeah, no kidding.
Coming in at number seven, what's your number seven?
So I enjoy talking about our presidents with phantom middle names. This is so interesting to me. So both Ulysses S. Grant and Harry S. Truman had middle names that weren't really middle names. So for Harry Truman, the S is truly just the letter S. So his parents could not decide between two middle names that began with S. I believe both were for grandparents. So they just left it S, just the initial. So he was always just Harry Truman. Harry S. Truman. And then with Ulysses Grant, his given name was actually Hiram Ulysses Grant. Famously did not want to have initials that spelled out the word hug, and instead started going by Ulysses Grant. And the S in that one came actually from someone who was writing his letter of recommendation to West Point, and they mistakenly put in Ulysses S. Grant, and he stuck with it for the rest of his life and was a phantom middle name there as well.
That's great. Okay. Yeah, I had heard a lot of different things about all of those stories that, you know, different usage of middle names over time and the importance of it and the like. Oh, and there was a whole thing about whether Truman sometimes used the dots, sometimes didn't. I remember getting a question about that.
Yeah, so technically it did not need the dot because it didn't technically stand for anything, right? It was just
right.
The letter S. But I think throughout his life you would kind of go back and forth between using the dot or not.
Great. Okay, coming in at number seven for me, Chester Arthur saves New York during the Civil War. A lot of people, we just think of Chester Arthur as that guy who, you know, became president and was vice president after Garfield, but he actually had a career and was the engineer-in-chief of the New York State Militia and was appointed by the governor, had a rank of brigadier general. During the time of the Civil War, he both organized New York State's contribution to the Civil War, which made it possible and meaningful because he was a master as a quartermaster and a master of organization and bureaucracy, and able to create the right systems in place to make sure that troops would be sent down to Washington from New York in a meaningful way, corresponding to the size and importance of the state of New York. When certain regiments got out of line, like the Fire Zouaves, famously, both in New York, and then when they went down to Washington, it was Arthur that was brought in to oversee the punishment of those folks and to make sure there was discipline by arresting rowdy members and locking them up. And
our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom, noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
No one else kind of had the will to do it right, including the leader of the Zouaves. And that's one contribution, but his most important contribution to kind of saving New York is when the Confederates had an ironclad ship that was busting through the Union blockade, and rumors were that it was threatening to come to New York, and perhaps if it had not, you know, and the Merrimack had not met up with the Monitor in and had that classic battle, it might have. It was Chester Arthur as engineer in chief who was in charge of the defense of the city and created a system of defense for the city's ports that could have stood up to an ironclad, because previously they only had two options. It was like this, let's take every wooden ship and just swarm it and see what happens. And somebody described it as like, you know, taking a 1,000 Indians up against a knight in chained mail. And you know, of course, that would be a metaphor that works better at that time than now. And the other solution was to actually sink ships and so prevent this ironclad by making the New York harbors too shallow so it couldn't bombard the city. Might have worked. The problem with that is you'd also clog up the port of New York for years to come. It's an easy thing to do at that time, not an easy thing to remove. So Chester Arthur's solution was to have floating cannons on floating materials that would be able to defend if the city was attacked by an ironclad and keep it off. And in the end, they didn't need to use that particular thing, but Chester Arthur was crucial for the war effort and for reducing panic in New York City. So sometimes we need to think of him as General Arthur as well.
Yeah. He was certainly a fascinating president who is, again, one of those guys who is most often forgotten, generally just remembered for his excellent facial hair.
The best. Okay, so coming in at number six.
Sure. So I will actually stick with Chester Arthur. You know, this is one of those guys with these presidents who aren't written about as much. It's kind of easy to pull out these great stories that have not been uncovered before. So Arthur was sort of, you know, part of the Republican machine of New York, was sort of, you know, just one of those corrupt politicians who were alive back in the Gilded Age and was sort of being pulled along by the bosses of that era. And then ended up on Garfield's ticket because Garfield was so honest and upstanding that the bosses wanted someone who would sort of do their bidding in the White House as well. So Arthur ended up there. And then, of course, Garfield was assassinated. So Arthur takes over. And the bosses thought that he would just kind of go along with their whims. But he ended up with a really interesting and mysterious pen pal, a woman from New York, who helped him change his ways from being this corrupt crony to someone who actually worked to get some reform. The Civil Service Commission wouldn't be just putting in the people into positions that the bosses wanted. And so he was actually someone who, you know, sort of showed that you could change when you got to the office, that you could actually live up to the dignity of the position. You know, there's this idea that, you know, people can't change, but Arthur is actually, I think, a great example that the people can change given the right circumstances and the right push that Arthur had from this pen pal. And he ultimately, I think, only ever met her one time, and it was sort of an awkward meeting. But yeah, this was a woman who had a big impact on his life. Probably something that would be quite difficult to do nowadays, write a letter and actually get it read by the president.
True. Reagan was answering a couple. He was into that, but I don't think too many get that way these days, or at least they're so highly filtered that they're not real letters of real advice. Let's see. So
yeah,
go ahead.
There's a great story about, you know, Obama. I don't know if it was daily or weekly, but it insisted actually that he read somewhere, you know, a handful of letters from real constituents that were a good mix of, you know, positive and negative towards him. And he actually had a person, I think an actual advisor, sort of going through and picking things for him to look at. So that's kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, great. Let's see. So I'm on six. Clinton was at one time seen as a person prone to exaggeration. We have this image now of Bill Clinton either as either people despise him, you know, and just say, oh, God, that guy, you know, because they're of one side of politics. Or maybe you see him as kind of this elder statesman type figure who used to be president. But I think people forget the early kind of Clinton when he came on the scene, and there was, and it was reported a lot in the press about some of his famous exaggerations. Campaigning in Iowa, Clinton said that he had heard about the legendary Iowa caucuses since he was a little boy. But when he was a little boy, that Iowa caucus was not important at all, and no one would have heard about it until the 1970s when he entered college. So unless he was a little boy in college, that wasn't the case.
Sure.
In an education conference in New York, Clinton claimed, "I suppose I had spent more time in classrooms than any previous president," glossing over Woodrow Wilson, who spent 30 years as a professor. A computer search showed that since taking office, Clinton used the term that something was a really big deal, in quotes, more than 75 times to describe the effects of a deficit on the ability to invest in education, on a Western Buffalo Preserve, the joys of home ownership, the dangers of guns. Really big deal. Some of his exaggerations continued even as he was out of office. He said to one reporter that was reported a lot, "Nobody believes I got out of that for free. I left the White House $16 million in debt." But typically, that figure was widely cited. But of course, most of that debt was legal bills that had been paid for by a special legal fund, and eventually with books and speeches, that debt was pretty quickly. I think by the time of 2004, so he left office in 2001, the debt was completely retired. Couple other things. He claimed that he had apologized to Lewinsky. They had never talked after the affair. He only apologized publicly. So it is interesting. I think it's just an interesting thing to point out because, you know, of course, we've had a president where some of these exaggerations seem small in comparison, but he ain't the only one.
Yeah, for being, you know, Clinton was a political animal from pretty much the day he was born. So it's certainly not surprising that he would learn that that skill of exaggeration early on and use it widely.
Let's go to number five.
Sure. So, you know, with Tyler, when we were talking about him, we briefly touched on the fact that he sort of convened this or tried to convene this convention prior to the Civil War. And it kind of shows the importance of ex-presidents. So Nixon was actually the last president to be president during a period in which no ex-presidents were alive. So he actually went through the Watergate scandal with no ex-presidents to seek counsel from, which I think is really interesting. You know, had there been other ex-presidents alive, whether, you know, Kennedy or Eisenhower or some of these other folks who succumbed to early deaths, you know, would that have been different? Who knows? And there's certainly a lot made about the president's club in today's world, especially since, of course, they're getting, you know, just the world's best healthcare and living a lot longer. So it's not likely to happen anytime soon, I imagine. But it certainly goes to show the power of the ex-presidency as well. And yeah, you kind of wonder, would Watergate have turned out differently had Nixon been able to convene with some of the guys who had come before?
Oh, it's a fascinating question. That's a good one. Thanks, Jeremy. That's a good one. And it's a fascinating question because one of the things that did occur, there was a little bit on the edges of that, is that they were, the new research has uncovered that, and the tapes have uncovered that they were contacting Lyndon Johnson right before he died, and trying, the Nixon and Haldeman and others, you know, really wanted Lyndon Johnson to tamp down the Democratic Congress in a way that he could because he had a great influence over the Southern members of the Congress. And then the whole Watergate Commission was led by Senator from North Carolina. So LBJ rebuffed, and, you know, one of the things they actually almost came near to blackmailing him, saying, "Yeah, we'll release things about what you had bugged our plane, or at least the allegations that had happened, and you had spied on us if you don't, you know, defend us in Watergate." And of course, like Lyndon Johnson, be the wrong guy to do that to is basically the reaction. But I don't know if he would have been alive, though, longer in 74, say, if he would have been able to broker some compromise. And then, yes, would the others, like Eisenhower, been able to give him advice? It goes in a million directions. The other thing is how Nixon then behaved as an ex-president, like, I guess, not having the experience of ever having one. He became a kind of a thorn in the side of Reagan, unwelcome guest in the White House. Nancy didn't want him there because he had been bad for Reagan on certain things, and the IMF treaty. And then George W. Bush had a lot of tensions with him. He did end up helping out Clinton a lot. Clinton liked him.
Interestingly, yeah, they were kind of oddly buddies there. Yeah.
Let's see. So now, of course, I lost. We're on five, right? So this is my number five was Thomas Jefferson's secret weapon, which were these casual orchestrated dinners that he would have. Not talked about a lot. Jefferson's presidency outside the Louisiana Purchase isn't often discussed a lot. But one of the things that made his presidency, you know, he's a two-termer, and except for that embargo bit at the end, was pretty successful. And one of the reasons he was able to control events was a very passive Jeffersonian way, which was to have these dinners, a very casual dinner. He'd invite congressmen, but also writers. His daughter Martha would be there. He would wear very casual clothes, at least for the time. He's in his 60s at this point. Twilled corduroy breeches, scarlet embroidered waistcoat under a more somberly colored coat. Kind of less costly apparel than people may wear. Sometimes the servants were better dressed than he. He'd invite anyone who was traveling, senators. There would be lots of wine. But one of the interesting innovations that he had at these dinners is he wanted to be sure the guests could talk to each other, that it wasn't stuffy. So here's what one account says. Jefferson dearly loved gadgets, as long as they served a practical purpose. Typical in his dining room was the custom of placing between two guests a sort of dumb waiter, a small wooden stand with shelves, upon which servants placed the food and then were dismissed, so that the flow of conversation would continue without interruption.
Interesting. So he was quite the social engineer.
That's right. That's right. And there's other functions that I don't want to get into all the functions of these dumbwaiters, but essentially it requires no interruption from that servant as food was placed. Yeah, I think this had a lot to do. So anyone who follows like reality TV and watches, say, a Big Brother or Survivor TV show, or anybody that's worked in the higher levels of any company on earth, I think, you know, can be pretty aware, or if they've had a political experience, of course, they could be pretty aware that, like, so much of it is what information you have, what's coming your way, what's going to damage you, what does this person think? Jefferson, in a very quiet and unassuming way, had it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's go to number four.
Sure. So I've done some writing and researching into presidents' hobbies for an Art of Manliness article. And one that was especially interesting to me was Rutherford Hayes. So he's a name that most people do not recognize, one of the least recognizable, actually, when it comes to polls about presidents, you know, people know from the past. So Hayes had this really interesting obsession with genealogy. One letter that I love, this was in a letter to a relative. He says, "I have an attack of the genealogical mania. It came on about 10 days ago, super induced by reading a family tree which a friend sent me. It is in a violent form, but I trust it will soon abate." So even when he was president, he would take time off 1 to 2 days away from the office to scout around Ohio and New England countryside looking for lost relatives and genealogical libraries, which, you know, of course, back then when you're out of office, you're truly out of office. So he would, you know, fully be away from work and go on these genealogical adventures. And it was a thing that he loved from as a young boy all the way until he died. Generally, presidents have more active, you know, well-known hobby, golf, you know, which I'll get into later. But yeah, genealogy was very interesting to come across.
Well, we're all getting into it. You know, a lot of us are going on Ancestry and the like.
Yeah, it's certainly easier nowadays. You know, had to go tromping around dirt roads, you know, actually looking for the houses of the people he's looking for. So, yeah, it was certainly a more active pursuit back then.
It is funny how everything's so easier. Even historical research is easier, right? I mean, I've always said, like, I wouldn't be able to do the podcast that I do without the internet. I mean, it would be so much harder. So that was number four. Let's see. So number four is, I don't know if a lot of people are aware of it, but McKinley, as governor of Ohio, signed an anti-lynching bill that was progressive for its time and was an inspiration to other states. You think about Ohio. Now, McKinley's going to become governor in the 1890s. This is the position that he holds before he's president, but after he's in Congress, he passes a tariff and then is voted out of office, then is voted in as Ohio governor. You don't think of Ohio, it's a northern state, and you don't think of it as one where lynchings would occur, but sadly it was. His legislation that he signed, it was something that he pushed hard for, and generally, having served in the Union Army during the Civil War, McKinley took the cause of African-American emancipation, their later voting, and their rights very seriously.
Yeah, that I assume that had to have been among the first anti-lynching measures. Do you know?
Yeah, you know what? Maybe I'll come in and do an edit on it. I'm pretty sure it was the first significant state to actually pass one. Okay, from the editor's desk, the Smith Act, named for Harry Smith, who was an African-American state legislator from Cleveland, Ohio, also supported by Governor William McKinley right at the time, as he's one of many names being mentioned for the presidency. The Smith Act allowed victims of lynchings and their families to sue county governments. Victims could also sue for up to $1,000, while family members were permitted to sue for up to $5,000. The bill resulted from at least six lynchings of African Americans in Ohio during the 1890s. I haven't been able to determine if it was the first of any type of law. What I do know is it was the first law with teeth. It was the most stringent anti-lynching law in the United States at any state at the time. William McKinley would go on as president to speak out against the issue. He was not able to get a bill through Congress, but he would speak out on a variety of things. One is the lynching didn't just affect African Americans, that there were, in 1899, he speaks forcefully about a group of Italian Americans that are lynched in Mississippi, and also recommends to Congress legislation that if a crime is done against a foreign national, then that crime should be prosecuted by the federal rather than the state government. That effort was not successful, but the presidential voice did push the issue, not often spoken about by presidents. Let's see, that was number four. So now, the number three obscure fact about presidents is?
Sure, so let's stick within the sort of hobby theme. Since golfing was sort of first introduced to America in a big way back in the early 20th century, only three presidents have not played golf. That would be Herbert Hoover, who was more of a fly fisherman, Harry Truman, just never got around to enjoying the game, and also Jimmy Carter, kind of in that same boat, was not much of a hobbyist guy and didn't care much for relaxing in general. But those are the only three, and certainly golfing gets a ton of attention in the media. Eisenhower famously golfed, you know, some 800 times, I think, over the course of his 8 years. Even Woodrow Wilson was a huge golfer, golfed possibly upwards of 1,000 times during his really 8.5 years of being healthy in the presidency. And so, you know, there's always talk about it, but really, man, the presidency is a tough job, and they need some breaks too. And they're often either, you know, with friends or advisors, but many of the presidents have rules about talking politics on the links.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's really interesting that they all sort of congregate around this one hobby. Yeah.
It strikes me a couple of things. One is the Hoover surprised me there, because he feels like a golfy guy, but some of that's just looking at the past with our modern eyes. He was also, yeah. I guess, a busybody and had other things to do, you know.
He was, yeah, he certainly fit that sort of aristocratic mold of how golf was viewed back then. Mm. But yeah, never got around to it. And of course, FDR, you know, never played in office, but he was a big time golfer before contracting polio.
There's this tension, and you see it, of course, even certainly with the last president, you always reporting his golf. Clinton, I think various advisors said, get the heck off that golf course. Like, every time you're seen on TV golfing with people, you just lost Joe America, you know? So, and I think it was the worst, always the downward pings in Trump's presidency was, you know, at least from opponents' point of view, when they had the images of him playing golf. So it's not a great sport for populism, because even though a lot of Americans play it and more Americans play now, and Tiger Woods brought a lot of popularity to sport, it's still a very elite game. And of course it requires money and a lot of time. Yeah. But on the other hand, mm-hmm. I can see the tension, because first of all, it's an elite game. So that's how many of these politicians met their power broker friends and socialized with them. There's that force field of politics you describe, like, okay, I can finally relax and not talk politics and be away from things, which is the president's crave. I know that was part of the Clinton attraction to it. So it's just funny tension between a game. I was like, the reality is...
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, Obama, for his popularity, was much better off playing basketball.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, his basketball skills are wonderfully highlighted in David Moranis' biography of him, if people are interested in that.
That's great. So I am on number three. This one's a little gory, but or a little sad, really. But Benjamin Harrison and his father's remains. Benjamin Harrison actually, before he was president, had to deal with a situation where his father's body had been grave robbed. And this is John Scott Harrison, who is the son of President William Henry Harrison. Benjamin Harrison, of course, is William Henry Harrison's grandson, previous president. And it just highlights what was going on at the time in 1878, that the family, of course, Benjamin Harrison and his brother were of course very saddened when their father passed. The father had some limited political experience, but mostly was just a farmer in the community. And there had been this grave robbing trend. And so they took steps to both encase the body in cement and also to hire a watchman to watch over their father's body. When then they hear about this other case where a grave had been robbed and Benjamin Harrison and the brother go to actually Benjamin Harrison's brother. And so what was going on is there were grave robbers who would take bodies and then sell them to the local medical colleges for money. And the money was such that this was quite an enterprise, and people had to take steps to protect. Benjamin Harrison's brother is helping out with another case, goes to the medical college. They start looking at the recent bodies to try to see if one had been. And then, lo and behold, there's his father. They just buried the day before.
Oh, fascinating.
Now, the watchman could not be found. They somehow got around the they think the watchman probably was involved. He could never be found again. They think they got around the cement and everything like that and were able to Harrison had to go deal with the medical college, see his father reburied. And it became a, the one thing that occurred from it is that Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, and Michigan updated their anatomy acts to include stringent prosecution of gravediggers and to authorize the use of unclaimed corpses for that the state had for the medical colleges so that they would not go pursuing this illicit channel.
Interesting. Yeah, grave robbing is certainly an interesting little piece of American history. And back then, you know, medical students often had to provide their own bodies. It was in this weird way sort of encouraged, you know, to go grave robbing. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Coming in at number, and I guess it also adds a streak of, why did I find it interesting too? It adds this streak of misfortune in Benjamin Harrison, who became kind of one of the more, have one of the more unfortunate presidencies.
Yeah.
So we're coming in at number two, most obscure fact, presidential history.
Talked about Martin Van Buren. So he is largely forgotten today, came right after Andrew Jackson, was sort of his heir apparent. And he is largely responsible for today's two-party system. So before that, you had a lot of really regional coalitions. There was not this grand political organization. And so you had folks who weren't necessarily, you know, winning majorities in the popular vote. There were, you know, issues with the electoral system, of course. So Van Buren comes along. He's a really brilliant politician, was sort of one of the first career politicians, actually, and came to realize that a national organized political party would have much better success winning elections than sticking with these regional factions. So he got all the state parties together and worked for Andrew Jackson. Of course, didn't get him in on his first attempt. I believe that was 1824 when John Quincy won. But then later got him into office twice and then did not win his own reelection bid. But that two-party system has remained today. He sort of realized that, you know, even if concessions have to be made, we will get the larger part of our priorities accomplished by doing it this way versus breaking down into smaller and smaller interest groups. So, you know, he's a name, again, is not well known, but it's someone who is deeply responsible for how our national politics play out even today.
Old Kinderhook.
Yeah.
Created the two parties. Yeah, it is. That's fascinating because absent that, you could have had more fracturing, more local parties, and the Whigs really had a lot of local elements. Obviously, all the parties split in 1860. The Democrats aren't able to hold on to Van Buren's old tradition that year, but they do come together after the war again and have a fairly consistent party. Yeah, it's very interesting to see that Van Buren, who gives you really like the kind of RNC DNC, if we assume the RNC were inheritors of the Whig and Free Soil. Interesting times. Yeah, I'm sure there could be 20 of them about Van Buren, but you know, we only have eight to talk about.
Yeah. He's a really interesting guy who certainly is someone who deserves a fresh biography, definitely.
My number two is James Monroe meeting Napoleon and being the only U.S. president to have actually met. And I'll talk about that, met Napoleon. And it's interesting. James Monroe, of course, is the envoy to France. And while Napoleon is leading France, and early on in Napoleon's consulship, James Monroe meets him. And at this time, there's a lot of optimism about that relationship, but perhaps a little bit of caution because Napoleon, after all, has trampled over many armies and countries and united France in a way. He describes the meeting between James Monroe himself and Napoleon. After dinner, when we retired to the salon, the first consul came up to me and asked whether the federal city, Washington, D.C., grew that much. I told him it did. How many inhabitants has it? It is just commencing. There are two cities near it, one above, the other below, on the Great River Potomac, which two cities have counted with the federal city would make a respectable town. Now, I find this conversation interesting because Monroe has to be careful. He doesn't want to convey that, hey, we're a weak little republic on the Atlantic here, which really the Washington City at that time, still not fully built up. He's having to count what I guess is Alexandria and Georgetown within its numbers to make it big. And then Napoleon asks, well, Mr. Jefferson, how old is he? About 60. Is he married or single? He's not married. Then Napoleon says of Jefferson, he is a boy. No, Monroe says, he is a widower. Has he children, Napoleon asks? Yes, two daughters who are married. Does he always reside in the federal city? Generally. Are the public buildings these commodious, those for the Congress and the President especially? They are. You, the Americans, did brilliant things in your war with England. You will do the same again. We shall, Monroe said, I am persuaded, always behave well when it shall be our lot to be in war. So it's interesting that Monroe's having this conversation with somebody who definitely is a dictator, whatever respect in history we have for him. And he has to be real careful because he wants to not show weakness. And at the same time, Napoleon, this little conversation is trying to get at, like, is Jefferson for real? Is he really a person of substance? Like, and of course, Napoleon has these opinions, Corsican type of opinion. He's a boy if he's not married, you know. He has no kids, you know, that kind of thing. And then also trying to suss out the in one fireplace conversation, try to suss out the U.S. defenses, but also trying to goad him into some kind of statement about, like, yeah, we're going to go to war with England, which Monroe certainly doesn't want to make. Few more things. Later, he would meet again when he's crowned emperor. Monroe will be at that ceremony, but relations weren't as good, and Monroe was kind of put in the back. And the relationship between the Republicans, the Jeffersonian Republicans in America, and Napoleon will sour, and they really do view him as a tyrant, a usurper, a dictator of what could have been otherwise a Republican, Democratic France. And they will both celebrate in letters, Jefferson and Monroe, when Napoleon is defeated in Waterloo, because that could have been whatever dealings we had with the Louisiana Purchase early in the decade, that could have been an existential threat to the United States. So that relationship changed. It's worthwhile saying that James Monroe is the only president to have met Napoleon. John Quincy Adams sees him. So, you know, I guess this is my relationship with Bill Clinton, right? I have not met Bill Clinton. I have not met Bill Clinton, but I have seen him. And that's the John Quincy Adams. He was at a theater where Napoleon was at one point during a stay in France. And so, yeah. Coming in number two, James Monroe and Napoleon.
Interesting.
All right. I don't know if I'll get a drumroll sound, but maybe I will. For number one, we'll get the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics drummer. Jeremy, what's your number one obscure fact?
Perfect. Sure. So we have had one POW become president, and that was Andrew Jackson. He's not generally thought of as being part of that revolutionary founding father generation. But he was actually a teenage boy during the war, just 13 years old, living in the Carolinas, and was taken prisoner, both him and his brother, and did not have a good experience, was beaten and treated very poorly. But ultimately, his mother arranged a prisoner exchange. And so him and his brother were released, but then sadly his brother passed away. His mother then passed away during the course of the war as well. And so because of the Revolutionary War, Jackson was an orphan as a young boy. And that certainly impacted his life and presidency and his later actions towards the Native Americans. You have to assume that there's some thought there as well. And so, yeah, he's the only POW to then become president. And of course, could have had another one had John McCain won against Barack Obama. But Jackson is the only one, and the Revolutionary War played a bigger part in his life than I think we generally realize today.
That's a great point. That's a great point. I recall a quote from him when the annexation of Texas was considered, which is an issue that that split him and Buchanan. I'm sorry, him and Van Buren. Mm-hmm. And he had said, you know, the British already got a Kennedy at our north. We don't want a Kennedy at our south. And it's that hatred of the British that stuck with him, as would with any of us if we got captured and, you know, didn't. That's great. My number one obscure fact, and it's only I had a hard time really ranking any of these, but FDR picked the gold price by picking a lucky number. And this, during FDR's early presidency, he tried a number of ideas. One was to hoard gold. In other words, it became illegal to actually own gold in the United States. You had to give that up to the U.S. government. This was an attempt to get people to stop, you know, taking money out of banks and just holding on to gold during the Depression to get some money into the economy. And that meant that the government had to set a price for what that gold would be, since they were in effect taking over. And how it was decided, according to his Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau, who also was his neighbor in Westchester County, New York, I believe it was on Friday that we raised the price 21 cents. And the president said, "It is a lucky number because it is 3 times 7. If anybody ever knew how we really set the gold price through a combination of lucky numbers, I think that they really would be frightened."
That's marvelous. Yeah.
Anyway, so there it is. The political magician. I think we see the New Deal as, a kind of like, oh, brilliant masterstroke to fight the economy. Actually, it was about, at minimum, 30 different things that were being tried. And some of them may have worked. Some of them may have felt good at the time or helped people at the time badly needed that help. And some may have not have worked. But a lot of it was even somewhat contradictory, like hoarding gold and that are somewhat.
Yeah, I think people would certainly be surprised to learn just how much of American history comes down to just random chance. Things sort of fall in line, or decisions sort of get made by default. And there are a lot of big things that have happened that certainly were not necessarily planned out and didn't necessarily happen just the way that they were expected to, for sure.
Well, this is great. These are all little factoids, too, that I think I end up showing up on various my history episodes where they're appropriate. Did you want to share your bonus one that you had, or is it worthy?
Sure. Yeah, I can do that. So, the other kind of back in this hobby realm, just so fascinates me how presidents spend their spare time. And Herbert Hoover was a master fly fisherman. He was a guy who grew up in the woods of Iowa, back before it was all farmland, and became really an avid outdoorsman. And both him and his wife traveled the world and had these really interesting outdoorsy pursuits. And he really leaned into the fishing. So post-presidency, he even wrote a book called Fishing for Fun and to Wash Your Soul, which I think is just a wonderful title. You kind of get the idea that of the impact that fishing had on his life. And there was even a senator, I believe a modern senator, who studied his life, who said Herbert Hoover was never more at peace than when he was standing in an Oregon stream in search of rainbow trout or trolling off the coast of Florida for fighting fish. Public service was his vocation, but fishing was his respite from a hectic world. It just, goes to show that, man, the presidents are people too, and they have interests in hobbies just like we do.
Yeah, no, certainly. I think Hoover's one that needs to be humanized. He needs a friend in history. It's not that we can't be rightly critical of some of the steps or lack of steps around the Great Depression, but he's somebody that really was a lot more human than the reports reveal. Yeah, if I had one that was a bonus, I'd also go with Hoover, and that one of Hoover's last moments of his presidency was convincing his own secretary to not withdraw money from the banks. Everyone was withdrawing money from the banks, including Hoover's own secretary. And he writes this note like, please take your money out of the banking system. The Riggs Bank in DC, which is still there, is a good bank and very liquid. Don't worry. Of course, his own secretary did have to withdraw that money. He was just too afraid during the panic that beset him at the last days of his presidency. Well, this has been great. What, do you have certain favorite biographies? What would you like to say about those?
Sure. Yeah. So I actually have, on President's Day, an Art of Manliness article going up about my 10 favorite biographies of all of those that I've read. So I won't give away all of them here. They go check that out at artofmanliness.com, but it certainly includes Ron Chernow's biographies of George Washington and Ulysses Grant. I will say, you know, he appears on almost any list like this for good reason. You know, his books, they're not necessarily easy reading. They do take effort and certainly an investment of time. But the way he penetrates the psyches of his characters is, I think, unmatched among presidential biographers. And his books, all of them are well worth reading. I actually think Grant is his best of the bunch. So certainly give that a read. It's impossible to not include the Edmund Morris TR trilogy in that list of favorite books.
Of course.
You know, if anyone
just passed away recently. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh no, he, no, wait, that's, was that him?
It was. Yep. Just last year. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it takes a very special kind of writer to capture TR's vitality and energy. And, Morris did that in spades, and certainly Candace Millard also does in River of Doubt. So that's on the list. You know, I would actually, this isn't on my, you know, my official top 10, but I would put, Kenneth White's book on Hoover near the top, really humanized him in just a fascinating way. And it turns out Hoover, you know, is one of the real heroes of World War One. And though we like to lay the blame of the Depression on him, it just, you know, it turns out that there are greater forces at play than just the one man in the Oval Office. And so I think that is a great book to provide context for Hoover's life and decision making. As I look at my list,
that's great.
Look at my shelves here. I really loved Robert Dallek's biography of John Kennedy, An Unfinished Life. You know, for all the books about Kennedy, there are surprisingly few cradle to grave biographies of him. You have all these other sort of ancillary characters, other Kennedy family members, but for just a kind of a traditional biography of JFK, there just are not that many. And I think Dalek did a great job uncovering, you know, just how big a deal those medical issues were, the, you know, regrettable personal life stuff, and then also sort of how he came into his own as a real leader in those, especially those last few months of his life. So those are a handful of must reads for sure.
Yeah, those are great. I mean, and I haven't even read all of course, the Ed Morris and the Chernows, but the others have to pick up. Great stuff. I wonder about with Kennedy if it was a problem of the family not talking, but maybe they would talk to Dalek or Dalek would find it.
Yeah.
That's probably a lot of hidden. Yeah,
I think so. Yeah. You know, the last Kennedy sibling just passed away last year, the Gene Kennedy, I believe. So there was certainly, you know, family around to kind of say no to access the family records and things like that. So I'm sure that is part of it. And I know Dalek did a ton of research, particularly into the medical realm, and did as much as he could. You know, there's still a lot of classified top secret stuff with Kennedy as well. So we'll see if we ever really get to the definitive, you know, insider Kennedy bio. We'll see.
There's a number of presidents, Martin Van Buren, where their letters were burnt.
Yeah.
And this is just a thing. Like, I guess we're not going to be able to do this. I guess if we live in France, we're allowed by law to disappear. But but for Americans, I don't think we'll ever be. There's so much on all of us and letters sent and stored in servers.
Yeah.
But I guess back then you could do that sort of thing. I guess that's a little bit of a challenge with some presidents.
It is, yeah. And I think there's definitely a few where just all the letters, all the documentation was burned. It was pretty common to burn one's letters back then. I think Millard Fillmore might have been in that camp. He is sorely in need of a new biography, but it's just hard to come up with that inside, you know, personal life to write something interesting. So it definitely plays a role. Yeah, but now, you know, it has to be easier than ever. You think of just the way that Trump lived on Twitter. I mean, how easy is it going to be to kind of write about that presidency? It certainly only gets easier.
And everybody writes a book. It's the Bush presidency. Everybody. I got a book. You got a book from his press secretary. Some of them before he even leaves office now. So
yeah.
There's so much. I had a conversation with Thomas Oliphant about Kennedy.
Sure.
And he said, you have no idea the buckets and drawers of papers that some future generation has to go through because we don't have time. Like, there's no – maybe artificial intelligence will be able to do it better because all of these things that they found and looked through and found different takes on things from actually reading the letters, like one of them was that Kennedy was really pushing back on the press, like in a way that, say, a Trump did publicly, he was doing a lot of that privately, and so was Robert Kennedy. Like, don't write this letter. How dare you, you know, you know, attacking columnists and things. Again, not publicly,
yeah.
which does change the dimensions a lot. But they found a lot of papers and just a lot of things that there's so much more paper on presidents and from his time out than you get on the others.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
It's certainly why, you know, why Robert Caro had spent 50 years writing about Lyndon Johnson, because one of his defining mantra is turn every page. So Caro spends years in the Lyndon Johnson library, literally reading millions of pages of papers. I mean, it's mind-boggling to even think about the undertaking that that is.
He keeps us humble because I think it's always, he keeps us humble because he's found so many things.
Yes.
And he's proven things or disproven or put things back into doubt. That all the stories we have about presidents, you know, we have to check ourselves. I have to do it. We all have to do it. Like, it's fine to tell a story and we go with what we know, but it's keeping a little bit of doubt that, hey, you know, it could be we're listening to political opponents. Is there anything else that you were like, oh, I wish I brought this up?
You know, I just, interestingly, you know, so I, in the course of this project, I started back in 2016. After the election of Trump, I was just sort of intellectually curious about, you know, how did we get to here? How did the presidency get here? Does it matter? Things like that, right? Are there other traits that make good presidents, bad presidents, et cetera? So I didn't plan it to sort of encompass, you know, the 1 4-year term of the presidency. But of course, as the 2020 election approached, I found some urgency in the project and decided to finish before Inauguration Day. In that time, I had 2 kids. Back in 2016, my first kid was just a year old. So I'm sort of always thinking about the role of fathers when it comes to presidents and what kind of fathers the presidents were. So personally, you know, it was really moving to see sort of how ambition always requires personal sacrifice. And there are really only a handful of presidents who were good fathers, right? And they would sort of admit that they missed a lot because of their role. And so as a dad, you know, I was really thinking a lot about, okay, certainly I have ambitions, but, you know, what's the grand importance of that compared to being there for my kids, to being a dad? And then interestingly, I sort of in the same course of that, I went from being pretty politically apathetic, actually, to now being a little more politically involved. I actually did some volunteering for a campaign in 2020. And I really came to see that politics do matter. That in the grand scheme of things, when it comes to social movements, that the real change almost always happens through politics. And so there were really some interesting, you know, real personal changes that came about from this project that I don't think would have happened otherwise.
That's great. That's great. And Jeremy, anything else that you want to mention? Like we could, like Art of Manliness. I know you're a producer for that podcast. Maybe some of our listeners would like to hear more about that. Or do you have any blogs or books or anything else?
Yeah. So my day job is with the artofmanliness.com. That's artofmanliness.com. And we're also a podcast, just kind of a general men's lifestyle magazine. So we do a lot of how-tos, a lot of history, philosophy, music and books, all kinds of fun stuff. So people can check that out and find all of my writing there. I also have a weekly bookish newsletter that can be found at readmorebooks.co. That newsletter goes out on Fridays, and I do book reviews and author interviews and lists, all kinds of fun stuff like that. So
readmorebooks.co. You've heard it here, so check that out. Jeremy Anderberg, thanks so much for coming on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics.
Hey, thank you. It was a real pleasure on my end.
Thanks to Jeremy Anderberg for coming on the show. And remember, that's readmorebooks.co. And a reminder about the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics Patreon, patreon.com/MHCBUYP. Thanks for listening.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.